right, come on in and have a seat, or not have a seat, as the demands of your infants may require. Thank you. All right, so what we're looking at today is how the Heavenly Doctrine makes history, civics, and economics new. And John King pointed out to me that I've got to take history off of there because history already happened, so it can't be new. So one way we're going to make this shorter is just talk about civics and economics, because I made a mistake and history isn't new, so we can't, well, we're still going to talk about history. But John tried that one out at me, and for a second had me, but then I realized, oh, no, it still is new. But before we get to any of history, civics, and economics, we're going to talk about biology for a minute. This is how we see. It's a pretty simple diagram for someone like me who doesn't know a whole lot about biology. But we start with the object, which we see with the lens, which our optic nerve picks up, and then the optic tract connected to the optic nerve takes the signal after it's been focused to the brain, and then you got all these different parts of the brain interpreting and telling us what we're actually seeing. So that's how we see, right? Is that good basic biology, all of you who probably know more about it than me? Well, biology, yes. Brian knows the trap has been set. It is not at all how we see. If we see this way, we're really not going to see anything at all. And that brings us to a passage which is a hallmark of a new church approach to all subjects. Thought from the eye closes the understanding. So if we think this way, we're really not going to understand anything. If we see this way, we're really not going to understand anything. But thought from the understanding opens the eye. So what does it mean to think from the understanding? If you get a chance and are interested in this specific topic, check out Arcanus Lecture 1954, because that actually explains to us how we see. It leads us through a similar progression as this diagram, but then says, well, it's not really how we see. By the end of the passage, what we learn from the Lord is that it's the Lord alone who sees. He's the only one who sees anything. And his influx into our minds is what allows us to see. So the more we know about the Lord, the more we love the Lord, the more we'll understand what he sees, and the more we're going to be able to see. And everything that he gave us in the second coming will help us see all things new from his perspective, if we're working at it. So that's not at all how we see. How we see is from the Lord. So when we look at history from the Lord's perspective that he teaches us so much about in his second coming, we're going to see it new. When we look at civics, we're going to see it new. When we look at economics, we'll see it new, because when the Lord said, behold, I make all things new, it seems to me that he really meant all things, every single thing. If we're looking at it from the perspective that he offers, it's not going to look the same as if we just look at it from our eyes and then reflect on it. So that's the basis of the approach that we're going to look at today. So I have a handout here, and the passages we're going to look at are in the handout. Did everybody get a handout? Okay, if you need a handout, I've got plenty more up here. Becca, let me just give you a few in case anyone else needs one. So here are our goals. I think we'll do pretty well on the first one, and we might touch on the second one, and I don't think we'll fail miserably on the third one, but we'll at least get started on it. Our goal, after another 46-7 minutes, is to be able to look at history from the perspective of these three doctrinal concepts: equilibrium, relation, and purification. And if we do, then what we're going to see is that history helps us understand the Lord's presence with us now, through seeing how he's been present with the human race through every single thing that's happened. So we'll get into that a lot more in the next few minutes. But studying history from a new church perspective will help us understand the Lord more, which will give us confidence in the worst of times when we look at what the human race has already been through and how the Lord could even use that in a positive way. Civics. If we look at civics from a new church perspective, we will look at any government system that we're exposed to or part of and be able to evaluate how it does or does not facilitate this concept called the common good that the Lord teaches us about in the Heavenly Doctrine. And when we do that, then we'll be able to be better citizens, because we'll see what we need to improve in our government. And then economics. We're just going to touch on this at the end. But in some ways, this is the maybe most difficult one, but I think once we see it, it'll be the one that's most evident, which is the view of economics from the perspective of what we love. If we get to this one, and I think we will, even if it's just for a minute or two, hopefully you'll never engage in another economic transaction again in your whole life the same way, which could be a curse. Prescott Rogers would say, when we took systematic theology with him in theological school, and any of you who took a class with him in college, you may remember him saying that the one problem with taking courses in new church teachings is now you're responsible for them. But really, it is a freeing and liberating process, although at times it can seem onerous, because now we have to consider things in our decisions we wouldn't have had to before. And that's even true with the things that we purchase. Okay, so let's get started with history. How does the Lord make history new? Let's start with a definition from Webster's dictionary. By the way, if you have any ideas or thoughts or questions, I hope you feel free to interject. Just raise your hand or make some sort of obvious facial expression, and hopefully I'll pick up on it. We'll have a little back and forth for as much time as we can. So history is the branch of knowledge that deals systematically with the past, a recording, analyzing, correlating, and explaining of past events. Everybody okay with that? Lots of different definitions of history. I picked one that I thought was pretty generic. So we're good with that? Good with that one? Okay. So what could a new church definition of history be? Well, let's look at a couple passages first, and then I'll show you a possibility of a new church definition of history. If you open up your handout to page 2, we've got two passages here. Divine Providence 187 and Divine Providence 212. We'll start with 187. It is granted man to see the divine providence in the back and not in the face. Also to see it in a spiritual state and not in his natural state. To see the divine providence in the back and not in the face is to see it after it occurs and not before. And to see it from a spiritual and not from a natural state is to see it from heaven and not from the world. So a couple ideas here. We'll see providence, but only after it's occurred, and only if we're thinking spiritually, not naturally. So it seems like that's got to be part of our definition of history from a new church perspective. And then this next one, Divine Providence 212. The divine providence is in the least particulars of man's thoughts and actions. That's kind of challenging. How long it took you to get out of bed this morning, the Lord's providence somehow was involved in that least particular of your thoughts and actions. I don't know, is that unsettling or is that comforting? As the divine providence is in the least particulars of things so insignificant and trifling, why should it not be in the least particulars of things not insignificant and trifling? So think of some of the things we've already looked at this week, which are not insignificant and not trifling, such as Matthew's presentation on the Last Judgment. Think of all those things that happened over the course of the year of 1757 that Brad pointed out. It's funny to say, a lot of providence going on there, but there is all the time and everything. But those were not insignificant and trifling things. We can even see this in the brief history of the new church since 1770. And the kinds of things that Bradley spoke about yesterday in the short history of the new church. Providence was there at every single step. And of course, it's there then, finishing up this passage 212, in the affairs of peace and war of the world. And of course, in matters of salvation and life in heaven. So some ideas, some bedrock ideas about providence. You can see it after it's happened, but only if you're thinking spiritually, not naturally, and it is in everything. The least tiniest of things that have occurred, whether they're trifling or whether they're incredibly significant. All right, so here's a shot at a definition. The branch of knowledge that deals systematically with seeing the presence of the Lord's providence in the past. A recording, analyzing, correlating, and explaining of past events in light of the Lord's continual presence. So just thinking of the two words, divine providence, I wonder if sometimes I'll speak for myself. I get lost in an overcomplication of the idea. I think it's in Apocalypse explained, it simply says that the Lord's providence is his presence with us. Right now, he's guiding and part of everything that we're doing and thinking. Now, of course, we can't see it. Yeah, Brian?
So this sounds like a particularly positive study of history. And I imagine you could study history with an eye to spiritual things. And, I mean, this is looking for the Lord's hand in providence and so forth. What about to see evidence of the deplorable nature of hell and its influence in pulling the human race
yes.
towards destruction?
I'm so glad you asked, because we're going to spend some time doing that. So, yes, we will look. We'll look at that as specifically as you'd like, Brian. Bradley.
One of the things that might cover a little of what Brian's hinting at is that passage that all under the umbrella of providence talks about foresight and providence, where it says he foresees what is evil and provides for what is good.
Yes. Yes, we're going to, I think that'll be a good one. We're not going to look at that passage, but that'll be a very helpful one to keep in mind as we look at the next series of passages we're going to look at, which actually deals specifically with how in the Lord's continual presence, he uses evil for a good result. So that goes to our passages here.
Principle or conviction, do you think a religious study of history takes an optimistic view?
Absolutely.
From conscience.
Absolutely.
Okay.
Because I think the Lord takes an optimistic view. Not because, well, I'm an optimist anyway. I'm a glass half full kind of guy. And conveniently, it seems that the Lord presents the new things of the second coming in the same way. And we can think about some of the things that Brad hit on yesterday, those overall trends of human history. Getting back to a celestial church, and we had some fun discussion about that yesterday. That's pretty optimistic. Way more optimistic than I would be if you left it to me to give you a big trend about human history. So let's take it and go with it and see history very, very differently as a result. And these three principles help us do that. Equilibrium, relation, and purification. So the next series of passages explain each one of these ideas and how I think they can give us an optimistic view of history, but one that uses and identifies all of the evil things we might want to think about and wonder about that have occurred in the course of the human race. So if we look at page 3, we'll start with Divine Providence 21. And so interesting, this series is in the beginning of the book Divine Providence, to give us confidence that the Lord does good stuff with evil things. The divine providence of the Lord causes what is evil and at the same time false to serve for equilibrium, relation, and purification. And so for the union of good and truth in others. So the Lord takes evil things that happen from a false justification and will use them to help unite good and truth in us. From what has been said, it may be evident that the divine providence of the Lord is continually operating to unite truth to good and good to truth in man, because this union is the church and is also heaven, for this union is in the Lord and in all things that proceed from him. However, as many have broken and are breaking this marriage of good and truth, especially by the separation of faith and charity, the downfall of every church, and as they thereby unite in themselves evil and falsity and have thus become and continue to be opposed to good and truth, nevertheless, the Lord provides, there he is right there, providing every moment, that they shall still serve, evil wed with falsity, shall still serve, be service for the union of good and truth in others by means of equilibrium, relation, and purification. That's pretty optimistic, right? That it'll still serve for a good thing. So let's look at what those three things are. The union of good and truth, this is on page 4 now, Divine Providence 23, defining equilibrium. The union of good and truth in others is provided for by the Lord by means of the equilibrium between heaven and hell. For there is a constant emanation from hell of evil and falsity together, but from heaven there is a constant emanation of good and truth together. So Matthew's presentation was on the reestablishment of this equilibrium in the human race, because it was just about snuffed out. And that's what happened at each of the stages Bradley talked about. The fall of the most ancient church, the fall of the ancient church, the fall of the Christian church, our equilibrium was in peril. our ability to have the freedom to make a choice. So the Lord first establishes and maintains an equilibrium when evil occurs. I'm finishing off 23 now. In this equilibrium, every man is kept as long as he lives in the world, and is thereby kept in that liberty of thinking, willing, speaking, and doing, in which he can be reformed. So the equilibrium is the freedom to make a choice. Now, how do we make the choice? That's the relation. And the word relation in here has also been translated as contrast or a related sequence. But let's read about it in a little bit more of a context here in Divine Providence 24. The union of good and truth is provided for by the Lord by means of relation. For the quality of a good is known only by its relation to what is less good, and by the opposition it meets from evil. So if we have a evil and falsity emanating from hell, but we also have a true idea we're trying to do good things with, this idea is made more clear by this idea, because we have an equilibrium in which we can use our rational minds to choose. The word rational has within it the word ratio. A ratio is a comparison of two things. So the evil wed with falsity emanating from hell and the good wed with truth emanating from heaven is what maintains that equilibrium, and relating the two to each other and seeing how they oppose is how we can go about making a choice. There must be variation in everything from its greatest to its least, and there is also variation in its opposite from its least to its greatest with equilibrium in between. So we've got two out of the three. The Lord has this equilibrium. The word balance is helpful, but I don't think definitive. Because it's not like you need 50 pounds of good and 50 pounds of evil to make a choice. I think you actually only need a tiny bit of evil to be in the freedom to make a choice. And the more you choose one or the other, the less you'll see what's on the other side, but still be making choices. So balance is helpful, but not definitive. Bradley.
Well, one idea at one of our retreats came up with that I thought was fascinating was he had the idea of balance and the fulcrum, but that the idea when you are more in good, the fulcrum moves over here, so you've got all this good that is kept in balance with an evil, and in order to change that balance, the more you have of good, it would take a catastrophic evil, as it were, to offset that balance.
Oh, interesting. Yeah, interesting.
I don't know how it works, but I've been thinking about it for a while.
Yeah, I'd have to think about it. I'm not so sure, because little tiny evil choices can chip away at stuff we think we're pretty committed to as well. So I'm not, yeah. That's intriguing. I'll have to think about that. Ethan.
There's some really nifty illustrations of balance, but not really balance, where he's talking about evil, the evil or evil spirits or whatever being, in terms of mass and weight, being so insignificant that if that evil was eaten, it would provide no substance, no sustenance, and also it would be smaller than a gnat to some degree. So there's this.
Interesting.
You still have heaven being the reality and hell being the denial of reality. It's not its own like Janus. It's not an equal and opposite force.
Yeah.
It has no mass.
Interesting.
Those sorts of things are. In our minds, it's a momentous either-or kind of choice. For choice, it's in balance. But for significance, it's entirely different.
Yeah. In either one of these analogies, for trying to understand this concept of equilibrium. If they're mixed, we can't make a choice. So that's why the equilibrium and relation is fundamental to the ability to operate in a rational capacity to make a choice. Because when they're mixed, and this is, the, when they're mixed, it's gray. And when we say it's a gray area, aren't we talking about something we're having a really hard time making a choice in? We need to have, the equilibrium comes when we can see the relation between two things as opposites. Just a little bit of social commentary, it's no coincidence then that you get a book like 50 Shades of Grey made into a movie. So is gray a justification? I mean, I haven't read the book or seen the movie, but I know generally what it's about. If you can call something gray, then you can, then we can maybe give ourselves an excuse not to make a choice. So, did I? Yeah, Julie.
I had a college professor explain it to me, the equilibrium thing, as being like a long chain on which there's a sort of a zipper element that goes up or down, and it is a balanced fulcrum, and you're on it, and you're deciding every minute whether you're doing a notch up or a notch down on your choice.
Oh, interesting.
You're still there, and even if you get way down toward the bottom, you can still gradually bring yourself
go
back
up.
Or the other way. And so each choice is even, but your general tendency is either up or down.
Interesting. And it's like the passage, who read it? Someone read it earlier this week about how every choice is a it affects the choices on into infinity for us. Okay, so equilibrium, relation, and now purification. Now we're all still talking about this on an individual level, and we'll get to history in a minute once we look at the idea of purification and see how this can apply to seeing history. So page 5, Divine Providence 25. The union of good and truth in others is provided for by the Lord by means of purification. And this is affected in two ways. I'm going to skip the first one because it's about temptations and get to the second one because that's where we get a sentence that seems to introduce the idea that we can think about this in a more collective societal fashion, which would then be useful for the purposes of studying history. So down at the bottom of DP 25, this is in the context of evils that are like fermentations. Now there are evils together with falsities which, when introduced into societies, act like ferments put into meal and juice of the grape, and by means of these, discordant things are separated and concordant things are united, and purity and clearness are the result. So when I see that phrase injected into societies, so there are evil choices that individuals make which affect societies. Now, a nation can be a society, a community certainly, or whatever sort of municipal boundary you want to draw is a society. And so these evils injected into societies through individual choices can have a good result when the opposing goods and truths are looked at and compared and choices are made and a purification process occurs. This is the use of evil, is to allow for that choice that results in a purity and clearness. The last passage in this series. These uses are provided for by the Lord from the union of evil and falsity in those who are in hell. That's where it comes from. The providence of the Lord provides that there shall not be in it any person or thing that does not perform or serve as a use. So every evil, horrible thing that's happened in the history of the human race is part of this process that can result that does result in purity and clearness. Now, if the Lord hadn't told me that, I don't think I would believe it. But he did. And maybe we can see some confirmations of that in U.S. history. Any thoughts, and I know we have some historians here, about looking back at U.S. history? Yeah, Julie.
How we treated the Native Americans.
Can you say a little bit more about that? Go ahead.
We made treaties and broke them, purposely knowing we were going to break them, and it occurred repeatedly, which is definitely evil. And the Lord hopefully is using that to help us see that fairness and racism is an evil we should not indulge in.
So the evils associated with the treatment of the indigenous population in North America has run its course in such a way where we come out the other end being able to have a common societal mores that says treating people like that is wrong. And when we see it, we're going to do something about it. Is that a fair characterization of this process in relation to what you're talking about, Julie?
Yep.
Any others? Eric.
There's kind of a speech that Gabby gave.
The Civil War, yeah.
Where we are able to create this country even though we have very obvious divisions over slavery and racism. And then at some point, for the country to get any better, it says, no, you have to cleanse yourself of this evil. And we have quite a huge war over it.
So slavery in relation to the Civil War.
Yeah.
For sure. Any other examples?
Kate?
Ooh. Maybe we teach at the same school. any other ones? Any other ones? Ethan?
Not an example, but the thing just before that you were saying, I'm wondering, is there a... In order to maintain the balance on an individual basis, there isn't, very specifically, isn't this concept that we need to go out and sample a little evil to kind of get some contrast and sort of create concrete then and that sort of thing. But we're off the hook because on a collective or societal level, evil plays this fermentation process.
Yes.
That's a really different thing. It's not, there's something, it's all, we have an individual regenerative calling where there's a predestination to heaven that we're supposed to embrace on an individual basis. So the use of evil is, it's different when we're looking at a society, or is able to be different, maybe.
Yeah, well,
than on an individual.
It certainly comes from individual decisions, but there is a collective effect. And I'll put a few more up here so we can keep moving along. And I'm sure you all have examples of many, 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 many more. And if there are any that are particularly interesting to you, let me know so I can include them next time I teach U.S. history. Actually, maybe I'll mention the one Beck and I were talking about a little bit when we get to the Soviet communism. But look at all of these. Kate mentioned overthrowing British tyranny. If you want to look at a contrast, a relation, read the 27 injuries and usurpations that the founding fathers say that the crown was working against. They're brutal. It sounds actually, well, I don't characterize. Just go take a look at it. It's amazing what they say the crown was doing to them. And the result, this nation we live in today. We talked about slavery. When you think about the evils that came out in World War II, think about those evils that came out, and think about really in the Western world the not again, never again sort of common moral clarity we have. Now things are happening. We look at Rwanda in the 90s and what happened in the former Yugoslavia, but that still there is a common understanding that wasn't there. Before the response that Nuremberg helped codify or make a record of. Yeah, Becca.
I just wanted to add that the other never again that's in my mind about the Second World War was Hiroshima and Nagasaki.
Yep.
There was a moral calculation to use those to help end the war, so I'm not judging that as bad.
Certainly reasonable minds have different views on that, for sure. Let's just say it was an evil decision. I know there's great debate on it. Even if it was, you'd point out a tremendous good that resulted, which is not using a nuclear weapon again. I think that's where you're going at.
That it's U.S. policy to never target civilians.
And would that policy have been in place if it wasn't for that decision? So whether that was one of these or one of these, we can have a lot of fun debating. But certainly we can see the last part of it, I think. And that's why history is fun to look at. And not just fun, but I think when we begin to understand divine providence's role in history, the Lord's guiding presence at each one of these decision points for individuals that created a collective result, we actually, I think, have a moral imperative to look at it this way. Because then our own decisions I think can more readily draw on the Lord's presence. If we can see him all along the way. Yeah, Gabby. Interesting. Yeah. Well, you can see we could have so much fun, I would say, talking about each one of these and so many more. And there are definitely related ideas to that, I think, that fit in along the way. But just one that Becca was teaching me about the other day is, so there's this, you might say, misguided CIA program to, during the Cold War, to buck up religions of any kind anywhere, because the Soviet communism failed in the face of religion wherever it was being pushed. So the Lord, in his providence, as atheist communism was working to spread across the world, somehow had a place, and I don't know how, I don't know enough about it, Becca probably has some more developed ideas than me, in supporting religion all over the place too. And if we didn't know those facts of history, we wouldn't be able to see evidence of the Lord being involved in those either. The civil rights movement, this is another one. Certainly there are all of these loops going on and on and on, and a lot of loops connected to this one in the civil rights movement. But if nothing else, if you read or listen to the I Have a Dream speech, in its entirety, it was a Christian speech. The principles of the word is what brought about the civil rights movement in America. It's a Christian speech. There is scripture quoted throughout that speech by Martin Luther King. It was an incredible contrast. And certainly there are a lot of things still playing out in regard to race relations in America that, in my optimistic approach, which I think the Lord is encouraging us to have, a greater purity and clearness will continue to result from the contrast we can draw that we couldn't before. Gail, last one, then I'll try to move on.
I'm surprised that one of the things you haven't done, it's not on the list, is the Vietnamese War.
Yeah, that might be a tougher one to analyze from this.
Common.
Say that again?
It's still so common because there are people who have been in that has been such a great effect upon their life, both negative and positive.
All right, here's my quick attempt at seeing a little bit of purity and clearness. Even from that, still so close to it. When we got into the Gulf War in 1990, does anyone remember the one of the national responses was, we are finally going to be able to respond in a way different than we did in Vietnam to our veterans coming home. That had a huge impact on me. I think I was 14 years old. And 16. And I heard a lot of that we're not going to treat our veterans the same way. Even if we disagree with that war, we are not going to treat them that way. And that still continues to be the case, even though there's tons of debate over the war on terror and the continuing response to what we do with our... When they come home, if you're ever in an airport, the number of people that will congratulate a person in uniform is... Now, there's other stuff still there, too. But I think that's at least one result of the negative treatment of at least soldiers in Vietnam. A lot of other things we could look at from a lot of different perspectives in connection with Vietnam, but I think there's at least one we can already see that from.
Well, we can also see the government saying we're never going to war, too.
Well, that could be another one, yeah. And you look at the first Gulf War, although some would say we're in the midst of wars we're not winning right now, too, so that's current events, though. That's not history. But current events is part of this, too, because current events is somewhere in all of this. Somewhere in one of these three processes, an establishment or recognition of an equilibrium, which results in the ability to compare, which will then eventually result in a greater purity or clearness. So how about some things that we're in the middle of right now? Who knows where we are? And I'm just going to list these. It would be a lot of fun to get more from you, but we need to still cover civics and economics in about 18 minutes. Okay, so we got North Korea, Syria, maybe Iran. How are those going to play out? Well, it's going to play out in this series of involvements by the Lord, and we just don't know what that's going to look like. Same thing with terrorism generally. Here's one. Now I'm even optimistic about this one. I am tremendously optimistic about this one. Because I don't think this fight would be going on if we weren't ready for it. Thinking about Matthew and Bradley's presentations. This fight wouldn't be going on if the Second Coming hadn't already happened. This fight wouldn't be going on if the ideas of the Second Coming hadn't already started to take hold. Because it certainly seems like the societal mores that are working, and I'm not making this about specific people, but are working to redefine marriage, are being met by opposing ideas. I think we're at the beginning of this particular thread of history, but this certainly seems like an important one. Yeah, Becca. Oh, if you're choosing it, you really got to go out of your way to choose it. I mean, you really have to choose it. Yeah, and consent. Has consent in a monogamous heterosexual marriage ever meant more than it does today? Just to say, yeah, we're going to do this. It's never been a freer decision, because you got to choose. It's not just, oh, I'm going to do this because everyone's telling me I have to. It's, I'm going to do it in this face of all of these other options that a lot of my friends are telling me work a lot better. No, I'm still going to do this. I think we're maybe moving from the recognition of an equilibrium into the relation process, which, yeah, Ethan.
Then you get a really new, fresh concept of consent and choice being not something you did back then, but something that you continuously do all the time.
Yeah, and
choosing your marriage every day, always courting your spouse, those sorts of things. In a world where you can't count on the fact that society will pressure your wife to never leave you, then
yeah. Now we're going to get to civics in a minute. We're going to have a couple minutes to talk about civics and whether there is a role or not for the government to play in supporting these things. But Eden, go ahead. And this was things that millennials valued.
Yeah, and everyone had the same list in how they ranked them. And millennials, the first group since World War II, ranked those two highest. And the millennials, they were speculating, over half of millennials come from broken families. And so they're having a strong, because the people who came from broken families were the ones that often ranked them the highest.
Wow.
That's a major swing. So that's back to their grandparents.
Yeah. Wow. See? Reason for optimism, folks. Yeah, Gabby.
Another similar story. Japan is in a conundrum. Their birth rates are going down fast because women are, for a variety of reasons, being given a choice to marry. And it's changing their society.
Well, Stephen Cole proposed that. No, he didn't really, but I'm going to say he did because he was talking about it. That next year we talk about growing the church through higher birth rates. So maybe that'll be the theme for next Jacob Creek. No, I probably should move on to that one as quickly as possible. Higher birth rates, the old-fashioned way, some might say. But no, so I think the point, though, that you're getting at is, what a choice.
They have choice now.
Yeah. Yeah, and in connection to marriage and all of the decisions that are connected to that are now, in anything you can think connected to it is more of a choice than it's ever been. And maybe one you have to go out of your way to make. Yeah. All right, so we got that. Where are we in it? Well, we'll see, but it's somewhere in this process, which is all leading to a good result. Bradley.
I'm not sure. It may be a next bullet or something, but I'm one of the things in the study of history that I think the heavenly doctrines lead us to is also viewing history in the context of in relation to the church specific on earth and how the things we see play out in the church come from spiritual realms that actually end up being mirrored in society. We have the one, I forget who was talking about, you know, in relation to the Holy Supper, the, you know, what they did with the word reflected in what was happening with the church. And so I often look at struggles that are going on in the new church, and then looking in the world around and thinking, you know, we're a tiny church, but things that happen here.
Well, Stephen, at the clergy meetings did do a little chart kind of like yours, where you had the Nova Hirosolima disturbance and then World War I. You had the, what was it? Something I think convention was doing that caused World War II. So, yeah, DP. Well, that may be. Different subject, certainly ripe for seeing new from a new church perspective. All right, I'm going to have to move on, but that's a lot of fun to think about. Thank you, Bradley. I just got that one up there. Religious freedom, very interesting to see how that seems to be up for grabs in a way that it hasn't been in a very long time, maybe, or maybe never has before. Because that's a fairly new idea, too, by the way. I think that's a good sign, but there's a battle about religious freedom right now. So not only can we see it in past events, we can wonder about where we are in current events. And in the big picture, I'm going to move through this very quickly because Bradley spent some time on it yesterday. This is one view of the big picture that the Heavenly Doctrine gives us in relation to the nature of the revelation that we have from the Lord, inmost in divine truth versus ultimate or most exterior divine truth. So we're back up to the inmost divine truth and a state of wisdom that's available to us. So I think that might explain why we're having some battles now that we maybe haven't had since the ancient church. Marriage will be made anew as it was amongst the ancients, it says in Conjugal Love 181, I believe it is. So that might explain, when we look at the big picture, why we're in some of the battles that we're in right now. Another thing you could think about is maybe it's no coincidence that a big part of the globe sees slavery as evil. When was the last time in human history that was the case? I wonder if there's a sort of symmetry going on here. Just a huge guess, incredibly speculative. But it wouldn't surprise me if we started to see some sort of symmetry. Now, of course, we can do that with a lot of liberty because there's no documented history on the other side of the symmetry. But it's interesting to wonder about. Okay, so that's history. When you read history or look at current events, I hope that you look at it a little bit differently because you can be optimistic that these things that are happening now that are so painful and horrible, whether it's a societal, nation, or globe-wide event or on your own specific situation, that the Lord's still there. He's still there, and He is going to get us out the other end in a more pure and clear way if we stick with Him. Every single time. Civics. We won't read Webster's definition. I think it's probably similar to what you might anticipate. Let's skip right to the New Church definition, or one possible one. The branch of political science that deals with how civic affairs and the rights and duties of citizens can serve the common good of a nation. So whatever nation you're part of, or whatever nation you're learning about, whatever nation you're considering to move to, we ought to look at whether it facilitates the common good or not, and then make decisions about how we can help facilitate the common good, either within that context or by changing that context. So there are some great passages on the common good in the Doctrine of Charity. I think that actually deals with it most thoroughly. They're on page 8 and 9 of your handout. I will just read the points on page 8, Doctrine of Charity 130, which says, "The common good consists in these things, that in the society or kingdom there shall be," Ethan, this gets to your point, "what is divine with them? That there shall be justice with them, that there shall be morality with them, that there shall be industry, knowledge, and uprightness with them." And then the last four all have to do with providing for the necessaries of life, whether it be protection or wealth or occupations. So that's what the common good of a society or kingdom is defined as. So we can ask ourselves these questions when we look at our own particular government. We can say, does the government facilitate what is divine, for what is divine to be with us? I think in the United States we're in pretty good shape. The First Amendment is a tremendous law in the history of mankind. It is a really good start, in my opinion, at making sure that we can have what is divine with us if we so choose. Does our kingdom have justice with it? Well, if we look at the 4th, 5th, 6th, 8th Amendments, 4th is protection against unreasonable searches and seizures. In the 5th Amendment, you've got protection against self-incrimination. In the 6th Amendment, you've got all sorts of protections, right to be represented, right to call witnesses, protection against double jeopardy. 8 is unusual and cruel punishment protections. Those are all related to justice. All related to justice. In the history of the human race, has there been a more just society? Yes, there has. But in modern history, I don't know. It's worth comparing. And then it's also worth looking at how we could improve on that as well. There are other passages which are a little bit more challenging, which seem to indicate that the laws of justice on the civil level are the Ten Commandments. That's a little tougher to figure out. Criminal defense rights are a bit more palatable, but how civil law would support the Ten Commandments might be a little bit more challenging. Does the kingdom have morality within it? That's more, it seems, obviously pertaining to individual decisions and the collective nature of a society based on individual decisions. And then in an attempt to try to get the last few, does a nation encourage a good work ethic, knowledgeable workers, and honest people? Industry, knowledge, and uprightness. And then finally, in trying to capture the passages on the necessities being provided for, are there opportunities for everybody to thrive if they choose to? So any government system you can look at. And I think the idea here is that the Lord says, hey, here's how you have the common good in a kingdom, how individuals can work within a kingdom to build the common good. Does your government encourage that? Or does it work against it in some ways? And if it does, what can we do to change it? 3 minutes left for economics. Let's go right to the New Church definition. A science that deals with how our loves order the making, distributing, selling, and purchasing of goods and services. How our loves order those things. One part of one passage on page 10. Arcana Celestia 10,284. The bolded part. That which a man loves and that which he wills, this he has as his end. Think about the last thing you purchased. What was the last thing you bought? Or not necessarily used currency for, but engaged in a purposeful exchange in order to obtain. What was the very last thing that you did in that regard? Because that's what economics is. Purposeful exchanges. You want to tell? You don't have to tell me, but go ahead. Ah, so it seems to me, if I can be so bold as to make some guesses about your loves, that there's some pretty good loves attached with that economic exchange. Have you ever engaged in an economic choice in which you were free to make, not compelled to do, that didn't somehow evidence something that you loved? Ever. Wouldn't it be amazing to study economics from that perspective? It's all about effectuating our loves and our economic in our decisions on purposeful exchanges, what we will make and distribute and sell and buy. And now how about goods and services, the last point for today, how it seems to me the Lord makes economics new. Goods and services. Two terms we're very, very familiar with. What are involved in economics? Well, it's the exchange of goods and services. When I was preparing to teach a little bit of economics at the Kempton Church School, I figured, like I have done with these other courses, which is why I'm looking at this with you all today, is let's think about it from the new church perspective and how it's made new. And I came across this passage, the last one on page 10 on the bottom. By uses, goods are meant. And therefore, doing uses means doing goods. And doing uses or goods means serving others and ministering to them. So why do we call goods and services goods and services? Because they're goods and services. And I was like, I was looking at a chapter in the textbook about goods and services, I think, and I was like, wait a minute. We call them goods and services because in a good world, they are goods and they are services. So on a micro level, we can look at how our loves motivate our decisions for what we purchase. But then on a macro level, we can look at why we call goods and services goods and services. Are all the goods we say are goods actually good? Are all the services we produce and consume actually services? So we both on a micro level and a macro level, it seems like the Lord makes economics new too, if we analyze it from the perspective of loves. It is 11 o'clock, and I know we have a parade to go on. There are questions if you want to think about and ponder related to some of the stuff we've talked about today. But that concludes my presentation. Thanks for coming, everybody.